Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the OMG MotoGP podcast post Qatar. And I mean, we've got to start, Keith Ewan, the championship battle, Martin versus Bagnaia, the sprint. It was suddenly looking very, very much like it was going Jorge Martin's way. But then come Grand Prix Sunday, it all went wrong at the start.
I'm worn out by it, I've got to say, with the way that Tuin and Froome. I mean, Jorge Martin had a diabolical Friday. Nothing worked really well for them. They couldn't quite find the setting that they needed, and he looked all at sea. Then you saw the interviews that he did over the weekend with radio, television and the like. They've obviously had loads of things to cover PR-wise at this point of the season. And he seemed so relaxed. I mean, I love Pecco Bagnaia and Jorge Martin. They obviously grew up as kids, came through the Mahindra racing in Moto3 and so on and so forth. I mean, they've been around for a long time together, so they know each other really, really well. And the politeness and the decorum that they show each other off track is wonderful. I mean, like, it's got to be getting to you when, you know, if you go back in any rivalries, whether it's inter-team or whether it's, you know, your friend that you've joined in racing years ago, it becomes spectacularly personal. But those two seem to have managed to keep some kind of maturity in there that is almost unheard of, really, considering the level of their rivalry at this point. But Friday was a diabolical day for Jorge Martin. Somehow they found a setting to work on the Saturday, and he just looked majestic. He looked so much better than everybody else. And we're all thinking, well, there's no one going to match him on Sunday, providing he can get a tire to hang in there on the full 22-lap distance. There's no way that he's going to get caught out. And then right from, as you say, soon as the lights went out, the thing went sideways one way, then it went sideways the other way. It's like the electronics weren't hooked up. It's like the tyre wasn't hooked up. I mean, it's funny that Michelin put out last night a very brief statement from Piero Taramesso, who's their main man on site. Piero Taramesso said that, you know, the tyre hadn't gone through any heat cycles. It was a brand new tyre. There wasn't something that was strange about it. It only travelled once or worse to that effect, because that's always been the other slight issue that people worry about tyres that have been stacked in containers that have gone by ship to wherever they've gone to, and maybe they've gone through some kind of process that's a bit untoward regarding the tyre longevity. So sometimes it's a rumour. Whether it's an actual fact, who the hell knows? But tyre shipping is a major thing, because they don't fly them everywhere. I mean, some of these things are shipped out in advance, but Piero Taramesso said that no, that tyre is a spot-on tyre, and they had no trouble with anywhere else. And yet, Jorge Martin was adamant that he'd had a bad tyre. Now, that's a rare thing. To be honest, I'm falling the side of Michelin, and that's really unusual for an ex-rider to be on the side of the tyre manufacturer, because that's it used to be spark plugs and tyres you'd always blame for a bad performance. And you know, in this particular instance, I'm wondering. Very rare, Michelin particularly. There are other manufacturers, I'm not even going to mention names, that we've had the odd bad tyre from. But Michelin, it's a rare thing. So if it was a bad tyre, it was fortuitous for Bagnaia. But then again, you know, the whole weekend really has got to be about Grassini. Fausto Grassini in heaven now. If there is one, let's hope that he's watching down on Digia doing the business. First ever Grand Prix, out of work. Rumours that he may go to VR46, but of course VR46, Uccio, Alessio Salucci, Valentino's best mate and the team manager, doesn't seem to think there's a place for him there. So I've got to say that it's looking, even though he's gone and won his first ever MotoGP, which is something that everybody sets out to do at some stage in their career. Bearing in mind, it's only his second year in MotoGP as well, which I think that is also, I ranted on about Rory Skinner not getting a chance, really. Digi's on his second year of MotoGP. He wins a Grand Prix in the best style possible and almost was pivotal in giving the Grand Prix championship to Jorge Martin, because when he passed back Bagnaia had a go at coming back, got sucked into a bit of a vacuum behind him and almost clipped his rear end going into the first corner. Digi could have been pivotal in the championship as well, as it turns out that Bagnaia has obviously said his prayers and got away with that particular manoeuvre.
What do you think has changed for Digi? Because, he was at one point one of the slowest Ducati riders. There was a reason. I know Mark, he's not being replaced by anybody. It is Marc Marquez, but he wasn't performing. And then suddenly,
well,
flick of a switch.
Frankie Carchetti. Now, Frankie Carchetti is an Englishman, has worked with a lot of really good riders over the years. And Frankie Carchetti, I saw an interview that he did with TNT with Susie and co. And it was interesting that he wasn't going to take much credit for the changes they've made to the bike. But I think that what was significant in his conversation was that the changes they have made are minute. They are in a different direction to the way most other people are riding or have gone to. But I think that indicates just where MotoGP is at. You don't have like a raft of massive changes that the old shotgun remedy where you change everything on race day doesn't work anymore. They're tiny changes where you move the bike towards a rider's style, and Digi's style and what he wants are different from the other Ducati riders. So perhaps following the data of the other seven Ducatis out there wasn't the way. They found their own way, and it's worked for Digi. I think it's indicative of just how good Frankie Carchetti is, and of course Frankie Carchetti will be working with Marc Marquez next year at Grassini. That'll be an interesting partnership when he goes, bearing in mind that Marc Marquez is splitting up from Santi Hernandez, which has been a long-lived... I think it's very smart, actually. I mean, if you remember, Valentino Rossi did exactly the same thing, dumped Jeremy Burgess, brought in a brand new crew chief that had worked in Moto2 previously and the like, and it made a difference. I think the good old adage, change is as good as the rest. Well, I think it is when it comes to a crew chief as well. A new understanding, a new pair of eyes, a new strategy coming in. So I think Frankie Carchetti moving away from Digi a little bit, going to Marc Marquez next year with Grassini is going to be a good thing for Mark as well, and he needs it, judging by the way he's looking at the moment. But I think that I think the partnership between crew chief and rider really, I mean, right down to the sense of humour, mapping eight.
Yeah, that was brilliant, wasn't it?
And then there's the four digits, the four zeros on the pit board, stuff like that. You think, bloody hell, what's all this code going on about? I've never seen that before. But it's just that level of humour that they have. Mapping eight was apparently the final five laps signal that they gave. And of course, every commentator, every worldwide, mapping eight. Does that mean he's got to give the place back to Bagnaia? All those kind of comments, which were quite amusing.
Of course, I enjoyed the on the board for Pecco in the end after all that. P2, okay.
Yeah, well, P2 was okay, 20 points. 25 would have been nice, thank you very much. And you pretty much, I mean, both Digia and Carchetti both felt that they had a chance of winning that race. That's how close, how far they've come. We had a couple of dips, didn't we? I think we had a fourth place, three or four rounds ago, and then it was, a couple of eighth and ninths or whatever it was, and then this blast into Qatar. I think the deals are done elsewhere. I mean, it's very rare you get to this stage of the year where there are saddles still available. Seats still available for somebody like Digi coming up with what he's come up with. But a great Valencia, you never know. I mean, if there was someone hovering over the paperwork with their pen, the old factory will have just been pulling them back a bit from that. Hang on a second. Let's see what Digi does in Valencia before we finalise this deal.
Well, I thought it was really interesting what Carcelli was. I watched that interview as well, and he was quizzed, of course, how can Digi not be on the grid now next year? And you know, I think Frank Carcelli very much agreed that he deserves a place, and sort of suggested that, you know, there are other riders in the grid that have been here for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe longer years, who aren't really performing, well, but yet politics and chat, and that's how it works. And they're still here.
The best one to come up with there, Harry, is Alacious Bargro. You know, you've got to say he's the oldest bloke on the grid, couple of kids, not doing the business really, although he's, you know, sort of pushed the boundary a bit for him. You know, he looked like he might be able to make some kind of step this year, but he hasn't in the end. You know, he's getting bad flack at the moment. He's just been fined €10,000 for slapping...
Slapgate.
Yeah, slap. I mean, I love it. It's been going on for ages, you know, like we've had these kind of handbags that, you know, he's an emotive man, Alacious Bargro. He's taken a fair amount of flack. I don't think that's necessary really in consideration.
But you shouldn't like
no.
Slap a rider while on a bike.
Not in today's world. Yeah, in the past you would turn their ignition off as you went past, you know, or whatever it was. But Romano Fanati grabbed a front brake. Well, hang on a minute. We used to do that every bloody weekend. You know, you grab your mate's front brake just as a bit of a giggle. I'm not saying for a second it should be like that now. We're a pro sport and you don't muck about with that. And they're the safety angle, of course, in today's world is much enhanced. What he did was he got off lightly, in my view. I'm making little of the offence, but I'm not really, because I believe that he got off lightly. A €10,000 fine and 6 places on the grid. Actually, do the stewards learn nothing in their terminology? That fine and that grid position penalty was for Qatar. Everyone was saying, oh, I'm amazed to see him on the grid, you know, because he's hurt. Obviously, he's hurt himself, Alace. So he pulled out of the race in the end. But of course, he started the race because he doesn't go to Vettel. You know, he wanted to get rid of those penalties just in case they did carry forward to Valencia or the next time, because, I mean, I've got the piece. Actually, I've got it in front of me. The good old as
he's got the evidence.
The few pieces of homework that I actually do, just so I get the wording right. So the action: a fine of €10,000 and 6 grid positions penalty for the MotoGP Qatar Airways Grand Prix of Qatar. Now, that for me is specific to Qatar, not a carried forward. It should say grid positions of the 6, you know, 6 grid penalty positions for the next race he's in. Because if he was injured and he didn't do it in Qatar, me reading this says that it was a Qatar penalty and doesn't carry forward to Valencia. So if that is the case, and I haven't actually just checked on any other paperwork, so I might be completely wide of the mark, but I'm pretty sure that was a Qatar-specific penalty. If he hadn't ridden at Qatar, he would have been penalty-free apart from the €10,000 when he gets to... And €10,000, to be honest, to a factory man is not... Yeah, okay, £8,000 or whatever it is, a lot of money to most people. But when you're smacking people about, if he'd had to go to court, I mean, I love the eloquent put downs that he's had from Morbidelli. Morbidelli was just brilliant in every comment he's made. Anybody that's not seen it, look it up, find him on Twitter and so on and so forth. Morbidelli has made Alacious Bargro look an idiot, to be honest. He's made him look very silly. He's called into question his emotions and his actions and his previous actions.
Well, you know what? When I was reading all that, it's not, you know, it's not what you expect from somebody of Alacious Bargro's, perhaps from where I stand, his character, because he's the man that's always at the safety briefings. He's the man that's always pushing for. He's Mr. Safety, isn't he? And he should be. He is.
No, I think what that shows is his emotions. I think what it shows is that he's fiery. That he fires off. You know, like whether it be for safety or whether it be for the fact that he feels that there was some, you know, misdemeanor that Morbidelli performed just prior to when he started to. I mean, Morbidelli basically said, you know, calm. You know, he stuck his hand up and said, calm. And that's when he got a smack on the side of the head. I have to say, there'll be a fair sized faction of people listening to this, watching the coverage that was saying, "Yeah, more of that, please."
Well, it was a bad weekend for Alacious Bargro. Not only for that, of course, he is injured, and that crash as well in the sprint affecting Miguel Oliveira as well, who is now going to be out. He's not going to ride a bike until February next year, by the sounds of things.
Yeah, that is, you know,
and he's had a tough year when it comes to injuries,
and that is It could, you know, it's all but career ending in these circumstances. I mean, we've seen it before with riders that have taken so long to come back and to miss Valencia, the Valencia test, and then have to wait until February test. Yeah, he'll be hopefully fit again by the time we get back out there. But he's luck. I don't know whether I'd get on an aeroplane with him. Let's put it that way.
Well, we do wish Miguel Oliveira all the best and a speedy recovery. Now, we've got a jam-packed show today because we're going to be joined soon by two members of Driven International, who are the circuit designers we were telling you about in last week's show. But before we do that, I do want to touch on Moto2 and Moto3. And I want to go straight, Keith, to Moto3, please. Because,
again, best race of the weekend by far. I mean, just... Yeah. Outstanding. A lot of pushing and shoving. And again, I'm actually surprised. Yama Masia, he got a conduct warning, you know, mid-race. But, blimey, he deserved probably a bit more than that.
Well, and his teammate, no? Mm. How did you see all that? Because, of course, Yama Masia wins the race and the title, but many on social media were calling that a dirty and unsafe Moto3 race.
Unsafe, I'm not so sure. Dirty, definitely. I think that, you know, he took Sasaki out, you know, intimidated him on two major occasions. You know, it's all very well getting it right. You know, you could argue both ways here. He ran him wide because he felt he was going to lose the front end into the corner. He'd gone in hot, so he ran him out wide, which was safer than trying to make the corner, slide off and knock him off. But to do it as often, he'd interfere. There is a rule in the rule book, you know, interfering with another rider's racing line. If you go back to 2015, the Marc Marquez versus Valentino Rossi at Sepang incident, where Rossi ran Marc Marquez out wide. They tangled and Marc Marquez fell down in that particular instance. It was only because of the cat-like reactions of Sasaki. Sasaki was on the best form. He was on top form. He could easily have won that race, and he ended up where he ended up, and the championship ended up going Masia's way. I mean, I'm not sure... World Championship's a World Championship. Masia isn't going to look back with any much regret on his moves. And he got away with it, so at the end of the day. But you get the feeling that he should have had a penalty. I mean, if he'd done it to me, I'd have been wandering around to go and find his garage at the end of the day. It's one of them ones where, you know, it was dirty, in my view. Whether it was genuine, only Masia will know. But I don't suppose he felt too... I don't suppose he had too many regrets in letting the brakes off and running Sasaki out wide twice. And then, of course, like you say, his teammate getting involved as well. So it wasn't the way that you would want to see it end up, but we are where we are. Again, stewards, you know, don't know. I feel like I'm sitting on the fence with this.
I think you are.
Yeah, I don't normally do. I personally think he should have got a penalty. He got a conduct warning, What the frig is a conduct warning? I mean, I know they can give it, but it's like
it's nothing.
You might as well just keep your mouth shut. That's kind of...
I think, is it the fact that, you know, he went on to win the race and of course, then got the title? So it's almost like he was rewarded for that.
Well,
for that
I think what it is that stewards and the like are obviously massively concerned with altering the course of a world title. Mm. You know, that's a consideration they've got to have. They've got to see... Is this just hard racing and a couple of mistakes mid-race, or is this kind of overly aggressive trying to intimidate your rival? And it was borderline that, in my view. It was borderline intimidation. You know, he was prepared to do whatever he took to the man that was challenging him for the title. We know Yama Masia can be quite hard. Sasaki's a bit more gentle. But Sasaki had the pace to win that race this weekend. We can all say that about just about half a dozen Moto3 riders, of course. Mm. But I think that the conduct warning was the most pathetic penalty I think I've heard of for some considerable time.
Well, in the end, Yama Masia took the title with that win in Moto3. Let's also just see off Moto2.
Well, let's finish off Moto3 very quickly, can we? Chan Onchu, who jumped the start and came through to a podium, was a massive ride. I mean, that was, you know, he got top rank Razgatlioglu on, Keenan Sofuoglu was on bloody the grid, you know, top rank going to BMW next year in World Superbike from Yamaha, former world champion, bloody. Kenan Sofuoglu, multi-world champion. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on Denis Onchu to do the business for Turkey. And then he goes and jumps the start. Goes to show you just what happens when you're a little bit nervous at the start. But a fantastic ride through a field like that to end up in third place for Denis Onchu. So I think he must get a mention in dispatches.
Absolutely, a mention there. Fermin Ardiguer, Moto2, wins that race. Three on the bounce for him, Gonzalez and Canet behind. Aguirre fourth ahead of Dixon. What did you make of the Moto2
race? Well, I thought Dixon was unlucky to lose that fourth place, but he won't care. Fourth or fifth don't really count for much in Dixie's mind, I'm sure of that. you know, podium would have been nice, but and he looked like he was up the second at one point. So Dixon was on good form. I love the way Jake Dixon's riding at the moment. I mean, I love the way he's riding, and I hate the way some people dump on him sometimes. I mean, Jake Dixon is right there. He's permanently a top six man. And, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, there is no criticism to go Jake Dixon's way. He is doing the business. He is right on the cusp of pulling something special off in Moto2 at the moment. So, and maybe later in MotoGP, we'll have to wait and see. But I rate Dixon very highly. Sam Lowes was down to 18th, 19th at one point and fought his way back up the field. He goes good at Qatar, so he'll be disappointed with that, of course. Fermin Ardiguer is the real deal. You know, like, he was imperious. There was no one that was in the same race as that kid. He reminds me a little bit of James Toseland. I know this sounds a bit ridiculous, but that's me. It reminds me of James Toseland, and he seems like an old man when you talk to him. He kind of doesn't seem like his age. He seems beyond his years when you talk to him. I always remember James Toseland when I spoke to him back when he was 15. That he was very similar, very serious man, stood to attention when he spoke to you and shook your hand in a very polite manner. And Fermin Ardiguer has got that kind of feel to me. I don't know Fermin Ardiguer because he's arrived when I've not been in the paddock. So, but I look forward to meeting him at some stage in the not too distant future. Talking to James Toseland, by the way, we're going down the pub with James Toseland in a week or two. So look out on OMG podcast here because we're going to film it again like we did with Foggy. So James Toseland down the pub with James Toseland, same place, Stirrup Cup.
We do like a down the pub, and if you haven't checked out the Foggy episodes, do go and check those out on our YouTube channel right now. Make sure you're subscribed and all that jazz. Look, before we welcome our circuit designers to the show, we go to Valencia. This is Pecco Bagnaia's to lose now, isn't it?
Yeah, but it has been lost before. You know, Nicky Hayden pinched it off Valentino Rossi a few years ago, a lot of years ago now. it can be done. Of course, it only needs, you know, something along the lines of what happened in Catalonia, for instance, to Bagnaia. I mean, stranger things have happened, but I've got to say, a 21-point lead with 37 points left on the table, it looks like Bagnaia is on his way now. The maturity of Pecco, the way he rode right up until he made that massive mistake, you know, where he nearly bloody threw the championship away. I mean, it was quite funny because they had the old heart monitor on Davide Tardozzi, didn't they?
Yeah.
And it was ticking along quite nicely at sort of 95, 100, 95, 100. It went boink. And Paolo Giabatti, the Ducati bloody director of whatever he is, the old fella, he's well in his 70s now. Paolo Giabatti is the smoothest, calmest Italian. He is the archetypical bloody, you know, Italian in motorsport. Even he looked really, really stressed over the weekend. I think that the problem is, it's all very well saying it would have been a Ducati one way or the other, whether it was Jorge Martin or whether it was Bagnaia who wins the championship. But the factory Ducati has got to win the title. It cannot be a satellite team. It was, you know, it just can't for the red bikes. It's got to be that way.
Well, we'll dive into more of that in Extra a little later on this week to preview the final weekend of the year. Next up, we're going to be talking track design, circuit design, going from blueprints all the way to laying to tarmac. And to do that, we're joined by Ben Wilshire, Managing Director, and Gary Dern, Motorsport Operations Lead from Driven International. Well, welcome Ben Wilshire, Managing Director, and Gary Dern, Motorsport Operations Lead from Driven International. Now, you're internationally renowned designers, racetracks, responsible for the likes of the Mandalika, Indonesia circuit, Abu Dhabi's Yas Marina circuit modifications. I mean, going down your list, you know, Donington Park resurfacing, the Buddha International circuit, of course, for this year's MotoGP, and more. We really want to dive into how that even starts, you know, from blueprint to laying of the tarmac. It's so fascinating. We had a lot of questions coming from our listeners who are so keen to see how this all works. But I suppose, first of all, Ben, if I come to you, tell us a bit about Driven and you know, the wider background.
Yeah, sure. So, firstly, thanks for having us on. It's exciting to speak with you guys today. Driven, we're... you know, an architecture and engineering company, but very much specializing in racing circuits. So we cover everything from the design of the buildings, the paddock areas, even how you get in and out of the circuit. And then, of course, the track itself, whether that's designing a brand new track from scratch or whether it's upgrading a circuit or resurfacing a track like we did last year at Donington Park. So we cover the whole range, really, of, design services but focus very much on racing circuits and proving grounds as well, so it's quite exciting and niche job to have, that's for sure.
You must have a crystal ball then, because the way things change over the years, decades if you like, you know, it's a fairly permanent structure, a race circuit, and a massive investment for whoever it is that's putting the money up. I mean, how do you predict the future? For instance, if I can stick with bikes for the minute, I mean, obviously you've got a fair F1 Harry's area, which we'll go to in a moment, but I mean, how do you work on something like, for instance, the parameters that the bike guys like, you know, the runoffs into gravel, the distance to the barriers, you know, the velocity of a motorcycle has changed hugely into a corner now with all the aero and all the bits and pieces that are now nailing the thing to the tarmac on the way in. They can now get into a corner faster than get out of a corner faster. How do you predict where it's all going to go?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, particularly when you're designing a track that is going to be used for cars and bikes, like you say, and then just forecasting, you know, what might happen in the future. I mean, usually we work very closely with the governing bodies. That's the first step. We talk a lot to the FIA and FIM about, okay, what's coming up in the future with ready regulation changes on circuits or even with the cars and bikes that we need to be aware of that might affect the track design. And then also it's really, you know, liaising with the track owners. You know, what are they trying to achieve? For example, you know, a lot of the circuits, they make their day-to-day money from doing track days. Are they running more bike track days? Are they running more car track days? And ultimately, what events do they want to host? So, for example, when we did the modifications at Abu Dhabi, that was very much driven by improving the Formula One experience. But we had to make sure that it worked for their corporate customers as well on a day-to-day basis. Otherwise, we would have ruined their day-to-day business. But, you know, we would have spoken at the time to Abu Dhabi about, okay, do you want us to think about MotoGP? Do you want us to think about bike track days? And then you have to embed that in your design. And kind of the worst case scenario for us, or the most challenging scenario for us, honestly, is when they say, okay, we want to have everything, because we're then into a compromised situation. You have to balance, you know, the amount of asphalt, gravel and gravel runoff ratio. And the big topic is always curbs as well. You know, what might be acceptable in a car is not necessarily acceptable on a bike. So we get into a lot more detail on these types of things, but it's really liaising with the regulators and the circuit owners to understand what they want to use the track for ultimately.
So Gary, I'm curious, because you mentioned just off air as well that you were down on the ground in India for the Buddha International circuit remodification rebuild to come onto the MotoGP calendar this year. I'm curious as to how that even starts, because I imagine the scenario is a bit different when the track is already there. You know, it was used for Formula One not too long ago. So how does that conversation even begin?
Well, first of all, obviously, as Ben was saying earlier, it starts off with the design. So with the client approaching us, we start looking at the design. We view Google Earth and things like that to get some background, some reference information. that's unless we actually get brought in to do a complete scan of the whole venue. So the design's the first element for us. But once we get on the ground, it's then actually reviewing the actual as built in relation to what our design is. So for instance, when we hit the ground at Bud International Circuit, bearing in mind last Formula One race was 2013, we was experiencing, AstroTurf runoff behind the verges for Formula One, which, disappeared a number of years ago. So that was a change. We knew we had to install some curbs, but we didn't appreciate the length of time it would be to remove AstroTurf. And it's actually the first part of it is reviewing what our design is in relation to as-built. One of the big changes at Bud was the pit lane entrance. And we managed to, through sort of use of time and inspecting of the circuit, we swapped out guardrail that was on the entrance of the pit lane for Formula One for concrete sectional barriers that was on the exit of turn, what is turn two, or entrance to turn two at Bud. So we managed to utilize, the equipment that was already there to achieve the end result in a more efficient time. So it is, from an operations perspective, and that's where my background comes from multiple circuits, is actually seeing on the ground how a design fits, how we can utilize some of the existing, transition it across, but make it efficient for the operator once we've completed our changes.
Like any building project, though, they're always over budget. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a situation that trying to budget for something as huge as modifying a track or even building a new one, it must be a nightmare to try and get that right. And if I can combine that with a question on materials and local contractors, we've seen so many times that hasn't worked out. I mean, we can go to the Silverstone debacle if you want to keep it close to home. They resurfaced the entire place for some £3.5 million or whatever it was, when most contractors that were involved in the end turned around and said, well, it should have been £5 million for the size of the place. I mean, they hadn't ended up having to resurface that twice. We've had Sepang, where Sepang was resurfaced at one point and they ran out of the local mix or whatever it was, and we ended up with half the front straight in one mix and the other half it's slightly different. So you'd got not just the sun being blocked out by the grandstand, which makes a difference to grip on one half of the track. You'd also got two different types of tarmac at one point. I mean, these must be nightmares for a company like yours to try and keep under control.
Yeah, it's definitely the sort of thing that can keep you awake at night, that's for sure, in terms of, the risks of things going wrong. I mean, speaking about what we did at Bird, and actually also Gas Marina as well, but in particular at Bird, we had what we did there is we had, a selection process for contractors. So, and same as at Donington Park as well with the resurfacing. So we actually write, a very tight spec at the beginning. And then we work with the client to go out and find contractors. We'll do like reviews on their technical specs. We're even looking at like what paving equipment they've got, who they're going to use to do the paving in terms of like the operators. Then we can work out if we need to bring in some extra people to do training with them. Before we do, like if we're talking about resurfacing, for example, before we did the paving at Bird, we actually had trial areas in the back of the paddock and access roads where we said, we sort of insisted, right, you need to show us that you can do this and practice and practice and practice it. And Gary and I and my colleague Keegan, who's a civil engineer, we were there doing all the checks and getting all the lab data back. So for us, it's about all the preparation that goes into it beforehand. Like we have to make sure there's a really tight spec, contractor understands what they're doing, and then we have to, get them to practice in front of us basically before they're let loose on the track. And that's proven to be quite a good way of doing things. Even at Donington, we did the same with fairly experienced contractors here in the UK versus then training. In India, we were working with a local contractor, a local construction company. They're not experts in racetracks, but we were able to go and train them and show them like what was needed and how to do things. And it's interesting, like, for example, we changed a lot of the verges and curbs in Bud. And, the first one you do is always very difficult, takes much longer. And then like the local labourers who don't speak any English, honestly, we have to you can see that they're starting to learn, and we're on the ground like training them and showing them how to do it. And you can see, like, after the first one, okay, I get this now, and we're just there to supervise the quality. So that's an It can be done if you train them properly. Yeah,
it's an interesting point you pick up there, Ben, isn't it? It's like when we extended term one for the runoff, you start off with 100 mil drop off, excuse me, into the gravel bed, and then it drops down to 25 centimeters. Now, to try and explain that to a local contractor that you need to set the gradient on a milling machine to come down, they don't necessarily understand it. Well, why am I doing that? I need to do it flat. That's how you lay tarmac, isn't it? But we was trying to get the depth to meet up with an existing gravel bed to extend it, especially at term one, you know, multiple areas at Bud International Circuit. And then before you start laying the geotextile, so the gravel doesn't sink into the ground, and then it maintains it ready to, you know, arrest the bike if anyone should go into, you know, go off into that area. But as we also know, with bikes generally, they're at such an angle when they come into, or especially on the apex of a corner. If someone like Marc Márquez is doing his traditional sort of lay the bike down as low as he can and it goes away from him, the first thing a bike's going to do is start catapulting. And where does that bike end up? You know, and there's no law of physics that actually says, well, it's going at this angle, at this speed, at that trajectory. So that's where the design process, working with FIM, actually builds all of that in, so we can try and understand, you know, all the energies that's in there, the height of the debris fence, the depth of the runoff, the barriers that's in there, the Tech Pro barrier for cars, or the air fencing that's in there, just to actually, you know, arrest the bike, but also the rider.
You've also got
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Situation that must come into mind quite often, because with weather changes that we've been having over the last 10 years have been quite severe. And at some of the tracks that we go to, drainage is, you know, once the grass is sodden and full of water and it's not running off and it's not soaking in anymore, you know, from a track design point of view, trying to get rid of the thousands of gallons of water that you get on some of the corners, that must be a tricky one. Is that all designed in as well? I mean, how do you manage that on an existing track, for instance? I mean, it must be a nightmare.
Yeah, it's a big consideration. So like on the drainage, so we have our civil engineers here that actually run, you know, software to work out, okay, if we get this many inches of rainfall in an hour, they can simulate that on the computer, and it sort of shows all the low spots on the track and where you might start to get some pooling. Obviously, then reality can be somewhat different if there's a slight imperfection in what's been built that's different to the computer model. So Abu Dhabi, actually, and you know, when we did the Formula One modifications, obviously it's not raining there a lot at all, and the problem is that some of the drainage systems can get clogged up with sand and things. But what we did there, they actually flooded the track. It was part of our deliverable was to demonstrate that the drainage was working. So we actually had, after the track was done, they bought a huge water bowser and flooded the track and tested all the drainage, and thankfully it did what it was meant to do. But that was definitely a bit of a moment for me, stood there thinking, okay, now it needs to, you know, let's hope this drains away. But we always have, like on a racetrack, all of your crossfalls going to the inside of the corners normally. So what we tried to do is generally catch the water from any paved runoff areas before it gets onto the track, and then on the inside of the circuit as well. And we use, you've probably seen them, like slot drains, these very narrow drains. And there's some quite specialist products now, specialist suppliers that we work with as well to fit them. But installing it is tricky on a new circuit because you have to make sure all the levels are, you know, you don't have a drain poking up or a sharp edge or anything like this. So on a new circuit, it's actually, you know, easier for us to design. On an existing track, like a bird, we did find, you know, we did have to go around and we were making modifications. We had to check the modifications that we were making weren't going to adversely affect the drainage, which was a bigger problem there because it was raining almost every day. We were coming off the back of the monsoon season. So luckily we were able to spot where there was like small streams or rivers starting to form across the track and we could address them.
We did find one problem, didn't we? Turn two, for instance, we actually extended the verge behind the back of the curb. And by doing that, it actually generated a low point, which gave us a puddle, which we only see, you know, after it had been finished one night and we arrived back at the circuit the next morning to find this lovely puddle sitting behind the curb or behind the merge, which obviously was a problem. So we had to install an additional French drain behind there, and that resolved it quite easily.
I tell you the bigger problem though, Keith, with the, well, not bigger problem, but another problem that people don't realise is the gravel traps. You can end up with gravel floating in water if you're not careful. So actually all the drainage under the gravel traps was, you know, something we really had to keep an eye on, particularly in India. And I have to give a big credit actually to Loris Caparossi from FIM. You were asking earlier about like working with the local teams and it's reminded me of the gravel beds. Loris was with us. He was out there raking the gravel beds with us the week before the race, training the locals, you know, with the rake, showing them how to do it. You know, he really got his hands dirty with our team and like showed all the locals how to do all these gravel beds and yeah, curbs and things. So it was really, really good experience to see like the FIM and all of their safety team being so hands-on with training up the locals with us.
It's amusing me because I'm just trying to think of a four-wheel world champion that's got a gravel rake in his hand to help the track designers?
Yeah.
Probably not.
But, you know, you have to give full credit to them for doing it. It's absolutely incredible that, you know, and the experience they bring as well. So, yeah, it was good to see.
Let me ask you another question. We talked about the modifications at Donington Park, and I'm sorry to make the comparisons between Silverstone and Donington. I know Silverstone you didn't have anything to do with. That was a completely separate contract and a completely separate bunch of people. But Donington obviously had that trepid. I mean, Jonathan Palmer, I know Jonathan Palmer reasonably well because we raced in the same team years and years and years ago, him in Formula One, me in 500. So I've known Jono for a long time. And I teased him when I was up at Donington the first time they ran on that track that you'd obviously smoothed it out. And I was teasing. I said, they'll only put the bumps in the same place. I didn't know driven at that time. I said, they'll only put the bumps in the same place because the amount of tracks that I've raced on that has been resurfaced and the bump is exactly where it still is. And it seemed like whenever a new surface was laid down, you would end up with the same kind of characteristics as before. Things have obviously moved on a bit since then because Donington was like a billiard table and there was, you know, got grip, it got everything they wanted. And there wasn't one rider complaint in the weekend that I was there when we first ran on it at British Superbikes after you guys had sorted it all out. And it needed doing because obviously the guy that wanted to run Formula One from there, I forget his name now, Brown Shoes, bit of a con artist, ended up digging half the track up and then running away and leaving it back to the guys to sort out at a later stage. But the track itself came out really, really well. How can it be that you've got it so right compared with how Silverstone got it so wrong? What was the differences there? How did that work out?
And this isn't, that's a really good question. And this is not just a comparison with Silverstone or other, because obviously the Silverstone one has now been rectified as well. And it's, you know, it's the same all over. So you're absolutely right. If you resurface any road and you just basically, you know, planing off, you know, a certain amount of material and then putting back, you will naturally get back this similar profile, right, that was there before. What we tend to do on a lot of the resurfacing jobs, and this is now becoming more common with race circuits, the bumps are always a big talking point, particularly in motorcycle world with the riders. And the riders have got such a voice now in the press around, you know, feeling of the bumps, even if there's no real data behind it. If they feel something and they vocalize it, then that definitely comes back to us. So we, with Donington and other projects, we're now using some technology where we actually creating a new profile. So rather than just milling away the surface that's already there, we actually mill away and create a brand new flat surface. And there's technology now that exists that allows us to vary the depth of the milling. So as the machine goes along, it can mill off 20 millimeters, 25 millimeters, 40 millimeters. So it can basically skim off the bumps. It's a huge, essentially a huge CNC machine. And that's what we design. So we scan the surface, we see where the bumps are, and then we create this variable depth milling profile. And that's really how we've achieved getting rid of the bumps at Donington. And I heard some feedback from the riders, I think coming to the final hairpin, there were some big bumps there before that they were struggling to break, whereas now they're gone, and the lap times have come down, you know, as well as having a new surface and new grip as well. So that's how we've achieved it. And that's sort of, you know, the design process we go through is to eliminate the bumps and give the smoothest profile we can. The big challenge you have, though, on resurfacing older tracks is that they have a lot of character to them. So, for example, with Donington, it's not got a consistent slope, like we said earlier. It's actually got a crown in the middle of the track. So you then need to decide, okay, you're going to get rid of that, are you going to keep it? And Jonathan Palmer was quite insistent on keeping the character of Donington Park, which I think we would all agree is a good decision. Such a heritage track, you don't want to, you know, over modernize it. So keeping some of those crests and folds in the track in the same way was important to him. The challenge you have on these, though, is that then you've got to tie in all your new paving to all the curbs as well. And if you've got curbs that are older, so the problem can, you know, the project can quickly grow legs. You start to resurface the track, then you can end up, you know, building new curbs, and you end up building new runoff. So we always have to limit, okay, what are we working to? What are the tolerances? And then we just all had an agreement across the team what we're trying to do. But yeah, that's the bump issue is resolved by some new technology that we're using, which is exciting that we can do it.
Do you ever get a bit of a smile when you see the way other people have gone about their jobs? I mean, there are obviously one or two firms around. I mean, I'm thinking of Dromo, who did a modification at Sepang that the riders, from our perspective, hated to start with, although they've all settled down to it now. The final corner, because that used to flood on the inside, the camber is naturally towards the inside of a corner, they turned it a metre outwards. So the water went out towards the gravel trap, which gave, they said, two or three different lines. Well, it might have done for a Formula One car, but for a motorcycle, we've never had such an adverse camber in all our lives. I mean, do you ever look in and think, I'd have done that different?
I think, you know, every designer's got their own view on things. You know, you ask 100 people, they might come up with 100 different ways of doing something. Like, of course, you want to do a good job. I think we just focus on for us doing a good job and looking at the work we've done. But we're always studying what other people are doing, like, and why they've done it. Like, okay, what's the rationale? What's the thought process? What's the feedback? Because you want to be able to, like, learn from what's going on in the industry. So, but of course, you know, we always like to see good feedback on our projects. So we're always looking, like, online at what the riders say, what the commentators are saying. That's a big part of it, because that's obviously vocalized across the globe.
Commentators don't know anything.
It's interesting when you hear the commentators as well, because, like, we know, like, we have the full context of everything that's gone on the project from day one, like what could or couldn't be done, and all the little constraints, like why we can't, you know, back a corner more, or, like, for example, why that corner was negative count. There would have been a reason behind it and a thought process. So it's interesting. No one really, like, quite frankly, probably cares about that or knows about it. So they only care what the riders think at the end of the day. And that's what we have. That's what I always have to think in back of my mind. No one's going to go, oh, well, that was done because of X, Y, and Z. All we know is that when the riders get out there, we want them to enjoy it. And that's kind of, if you take that approach, I think if you think with that mindset, it's probably not a bad way to think about it.
And I think part from our job on the Bud circuit, we help feed information back into the riders. So, for instance, as we know, there was a couple of outspoken riders, concerns of going to India. And we met with the FIM to do an inspection, and they wanted to do more. But from a driven perspective, we got back out to the track early. We decided to start doing, you know, daily conference calls with them. But as part of that process, we actually started using a drone just in a follow me process. So we was giving them daily updates on the work that was happening, how things were progressing, then Loris and Tom A could actually review those, feed information back to us on things they felt still needed attention. We could give them daily updates on what work was happening through the day, because obviously the time difference. But then actually one of the videos that we presented, they showed to the riders in one of their meetings. So it gave a bit of confidence to the riders that it wasn't, shall we say, media talk that they'd seen no sight of what the circuit was. It allayed some of their concerns. So we were trying to work as part of that process to allay any concerns and actually give them a bit of confidence that when they arrived at the track, they weren't going to find some scary things that would upset them.
Riders are an emotive bunch, there's no doubt about it. And now they've got a riders' union coming for next year. That could be a bone of contention here and there. But it's happened on many racetracks. I mean, Thai, the Chang International was one that riders weren't particularly, I think Valentino Rossi was quite vociferous about not going there. Didn't see the point in going there, didn't understand the reasons for going there. That was, not so much to do with the track as the location, I think, as that goes. But I mean, riders do appreciate that connectivity. And moving it into the more, shallow side of things, commentators really appreciate a connection with you guys. There's no doubt in my mind that when I was commentating on MotoGP, I would really have appreciated a connection with the people directly involved in producing the track and the nuances surrounding that and why that was like it. It's like everything else, isn't it? Social media nowadays, we've had an instance with Pecco Bagnaia, who picked up on something that I'd said that earlier on in the year, where it was just, it was a headline, it was a clickbait type headline, and basically Pecco had read that, but hadn't looked at the context, hadn't looked at the podcast itself. And I would imagine it's a similar thing in a much more substantial way as to what you guys do. The lack of understanding in what you are actually doing, and people pick on the tiniest little, well, I won't say fault, but little nuance, little difference that there is, a transition to curb or whatever it might be. But I think an understanding would be much better from a commentary point of view, Ben, as well. We might be more sympathetic to the odd bump then.
I think Ben picked up on that earlier, Keith, and you're right. You know, some of our circuit designs, there's multiple designs going to a corner before you actually get to the final result. And we found that with Bird. There was a number of corners that we came up with multiple configurations. And by the time you run the simulations, you actually looked at what was on the ground, and then it comes into the budget, as you mentioned earlier. You start looking at ways to actually achieve the target objective of, good close racing, safe racing or safe an environment for the racing to happen. So some of that information coming into a commentator gives the bigger picture for the fan base as well, doesn't it? They understand why things are changed a certain way and potentially stops the negative, keyboard warriors, as we say, to attack a certain situation. Not everything's right, and as I think Ben mentioned earlier, there's some circuits we look at and think, okay, that's an interesting one. How can we improve on that for our next designs?
Well, like with Bud, for example, is a good example, good one to pick up. Like you would have seen a lot of the corners were narrowed with painted curbs. So in an ideal world, if we'd had more time and more budget, to your point earlier, Keith, we might have built new corners specifically for MotoGP, but it just wasn't practical. And that might be something that's done in the longer term, with the championship going there for many years. We may look at making more improvements as the track, continues to host the championship. But like year one, with the time that we had and the budget was in place and to get the race ready, doing the narrowing worked for reducing the speeds. And I think it looked good on television as well. I think all the riders liked it. It was something that we were really like thinking, probably overthinking, to be honest. And it would be good, talking to the commentators and stuff to explain all the motions that have gone through, because it makes your job more informative as well to the audience.
So we could use, turn 12 as an example. Turn 12, it from a Formula One car, the safety guardrail on the left hand side pinched the track a bit narrower, which wasn't ideal for bikes. So when we first looked at that, the intention was to reprofile the corner, push the barriers a long way back, but by doing that meant we needed to relocate a grandstand, build a new extended bund, because all of Bud is actually on reclaimed land and raised ground. So it's a thing called cut and fill, and it's all fill there. So we would have needed to move the grandstand, increase the bund, move the service road, move the barrier back, but actually by pinching a bit of the service road to gain another 4 meters, reprofiling part of the gravel bed, and using the, as was said, you know, the Red Bull Ring style of track painting, we managed to achieve the objective that we was all after, and that was a later apex, tighten the riders up a bit more, because we didn't want to increase the speed going into the last corner. So was that the ideal solution? No, but budget and simulations allowed us to achieve that by the actions that we took.
What about long lap penalties? Because we had a lot of questions coming on this, like a lot. So this is speaking for quite a few people that were tuned in. You know, is there much consideration around that to try and keep it uniform within the calendar of tracks? Why is it 1.5 seconds for one track and maybe up to 3 seconds for another track?
That's a great question. So to be honest, it's usually where it's safe to do. So for example, like a Bird, what we're looking for there is a large runoff area or somewhere on the side of the track where you can come off. You know, you need it to be almost, you need to be thinking of it like a pit lane almost, that you need to be offline coming into it and, you know, coming into the penalty loop and then back out again, so you're not kind of rejoining in traffic or on the racing line. So you're kind of creating a almost like a pit lane, but within the track. So it really comes down to where can you put it? Like at Bud, for example, we've got one of the longest straights on the calendar, the back straight. There's actually a, you know, decent sized asphalt runoff area right at the end of it. So in theory, you could have put the long lap penalty there, but I don't think anyone would have thanked us for it, because you've got riders braking hard on the racing line, you know, from very, very high speed, and then they've been rejoining on the racing line. And then there was pretty limited areas where you could put it. You know, you're either onto grass or gravel at that point if you go off the track anywhere else. So at Bud, we ended up on the outside of turn three. It was a much lower speed hairpin. People could come off the racing line, back out. And so it's really it really is just where we can put it. Amanda Lico hit it on the outside of a corner as well. It was kind of off the racing line, slow speed, and they're able to rejoin. That's really the process we go through, is where is safe to put it, I think, is the main driver for that. Rather than make it like a consistent, you know, consistent speed for every track.
Which brings me to that bone of contention of pit lane exits and stuff like that into fast corners. You know, when you've got tracks that have been on the calendar for years and years, you must wince at where some of these exits and entries to pit lane are placed. I'm thinking, in my mind, I'm thinking Phillip Island. There's not much you can do with a place in a conservation area like that anyway, which is another area that we probably shouldn't go to when it comes to the government saying what you can and can't do, like Laguna and Phillip Island and places like that. But the coming out around the outside of a massively fast corner, Doohan's corner at somewhere like Phillip Island, and we've seen it before when a bike comes off and wipes out someone who's coming out of pit lane. I mean, when you look at a track, do you, when you're refurbing a track, do you look at it and think to yourself, we've got to try and change this? We've got to try and persuade these guys to put the pit complex on the other side of the track to get it to work?
Yeah. So my philosophy, rightly or wrongly, is that if we're designing a brand new track, we always try, where possible, to put the pit lane so that you end up with a racing line like on the other side to the pit wall. So it gives people enough, you know, keeps the bikes and cars as far away from the pit wall as possible. Obviously, that's not always practical. So Mandalika, actually, a story around there, if you know the track layout, you'll know that the pit lane does come in on the outside of turn one. We actually, at one point, had the whole paddock complex on the infield, the track, which is like more traditional. But at the time that we were planning that venue and designing it, the land wasn't available. They didn't own the land. So it was impossible to do it. And we even had sketches, you know, I have to dig them out, actually, the pit lane on the infield. But if you notice on that track still, you know, you come into the pits offline. It directs the riders away from the racing line. I think when you have something where you've got the pit lane coming in, like at Mandalika, and Donington's a good example as well, where it kind of rejoins on the, you know, near to the racing line, we always try to just give as much visibility as possible, as if you're kind of joining a motorway type philosophy. But it's always a headache. It's always a headache for us. And that actually is something that's like, if we're designing a new track, it's one of the very first things we look at is, where do you put your paddock? Because you can't put your paddock on the side of a hill. So you're always looking for a flat area. So that decides where your paddock goes. That decides where your start finish straight goes. And then from there, you've kind of got your pit lane design. So it's, yeah, you hit on a good point. It's always a bit of a headache for us.
Can I just follow? I see Harry that was ready to jump in on me there, but I just want to go to the bone of contention that we have here in the UK mostly, is just when you've got the perfect design and materials and everything sorted out and you think, yes, I've nailed this. And then you get some shiny bum polishing up his chair in the planning office at the local authority that want to completely upset this wonderful design you've got. Do you find that around the world as well? Is it something that we have just here in the UK, or do you have planning offices in every other country as well that are always trying to interfere with your design?
It's a good question. I would say in the UK, actually, funnily enough, it's like, because of the planning system we have here, everything's actually pretty clear from the outset. Like, a lot of the planning hurdles, we usually knock down a lot of the yellow flags or red flags pretty early on, because you know if a piece of land is classified as like protected, or you know if something's a heritage asset. So you can kind of work through that quite well in the UK and then have like consultation period. In other countries around the world, it's less formalized. We've been doing a lot of street circuits in India at the moment, and the amount of design changes we're making kind of like reactively, because there's something that we're like a road that we can't use, or we can't knock down a curbstone or something like that. So I would say less in the UK, but some other countries overseas where there's probably less formalized planning systems, we have a big reaction to it, and that can cause like quite late design changes, which is accept that it's part of the process and go through it, but it definitely can be a big hurdle for us to cross, that's for sure.
I think the bit that we do find though is, once the circuit's designed, it's more when it comes into the operational phase. So when you actually start putting events on, the actual government agencies that you need to jump through hoops for to actually make sure that you can have road closures, so you can have traffic coming in, traffic coming out, you know, what's your evacuation plan? That's when things start changing in different countries, whereas obviously the UK is a bit more used to doing large-scale events and, you know, safety security plans and things like that.
During the biggest headache for us, honestly, Keith, if we had something approved by the FIM or FIA, and then we get on the ground and they say, can you change it? Like, we need to pull the runoff area back by 2 meters. Obviously, that's a safety issue. So we're there saying, well, hold on a minute, the design's already been approved and signed off by the FIM, and now we want to change it. That's when it gets difficult, because they're then back into like reprocessing, you know, and reevaluating the design on the ground. So yeah, it's a challenge for sure. But
it's a bit more complex than I thought it was.
Yeah, you just have to be able to adapt. I mean, some people don't like changes in life, but we have to get used to it, I think, sometimes with what we do.
So just to go, because we talked a lot about redesigning tracks, and you mentioned Mandalika there, which is obviously something you designed fully. What was the brief for that when you were first given it?
So we worked very closely with Mark One Consulting, Mark Hughes, who operates a lot of venues around the world. Really, really good guy to work with. He'd been involved in the project initially, like just looking at the brief. So the Mandalika circuit is actually designed as a ring road for the resort, believe it or not. So there was already a road planned, and if you look at Mandalika now, like the whole island of Lombok, in particular area, Akuta Beach and all along there, there's more hotels popping up. And so the circuit was already, there was already this idea that we're gonna have this road around the, you know, around the resort. And the idea was, well, why don't we, it could be a street track, it could be a street race. You know, in kind of like pictures of Monaco and things like this flashing, Singapore flashing through people's heads. Obviously, you know, MotoGP, you're not going to get away with doing that without having the walls right up against the track. So the track design was derived from this street road. You know, that's where it came from, really. And we had some flexibility to sort of change bits, so some land parcels we could use and couldn't use. But that's really where it came from initially. And it was kind of, you know, I think even nowadays, still the track is called Mandalika Street Circuit, I believe, International Street Circuit, unless I'm mistaken. So was designed as a street circuit. And then the one thing that we had to flag and had raised concerns on was, well, you know, if it becomes a true street circuit, you're going to get people driving all over it all the way around the year. And then again, you get wheel spillages, bumps, you know, all sorts of other things occurring. So the service road in Mandalika, which goes all the way around the edge of the track, is now actually, that is now used as the resort road, or could be. And we made it like a two-way road. So the barrier in the middle can be moved back and it splits and you end up with a two-way service road, and it means the track is protected. But that's how that came about. So the brief was, you need to stick to this kind of route that we've got, but you can have freedom to design corners and stuff within that route. So when I first looked at it, honestly, I thought, this is going to be difficult to make happen, especially with all the hills there as well that we had to work around. But it looks, it's come out really cool. I think it's one of the nicer layouts on the calendar, I think.
You talked about sleepless nights earlier on. Bloody hell, I can imagine. It must be in the middle of the night when you wake up suddenly with a problem that's been in your head for the week, and all of a sudden you wake up with a solution. It must feel like eureka.
Yeah, it's nice. And like, what's nice for us as well is when things start to click in place and you tick off, like I said, some of these yellow flags or red flags. Okay, you know you can't use that land, so let's not even think about that idea anymore. Or, and then also we put things on the simulator, Keith, as well. So even just like we will drive a lot of the motorcycle tracks on the simulator, which you might cringe at, but we actually drive them in single seaters and kind of just get a feeling. So that cements a lot of our ideas as well. You start to put a bit of data behind it on the simulator and you can actually drive it at one-to-one scale. It definitely helps you sleep better at night.
sounds like an awful job.
I know,
have,
yeah.
Awful, terrible.
I didn't play video games all day.
Yeah. We were saying about some of the, you know, parcels of land of what you've got, and you know the specification, the brief, what you're building to start depends on what you're looking to run there and what their future expectations are. So if you get the brief straight away that it's going to be F1 or MotoGP, you know immediately X amount of garages, size of race control, or specification of race control, medical center, you know, two helipads, etc., etc. So a lot of your land is taken up before you even start considering. And that's where Ben was saying, you know, what's the flattest piece of land? Does that work? Do we need to start doing a lot of excavation work to make that flat piece for the paddock? You know, is it going to be a European race? So you've got, you know, Moto 2, Moto 3 going in there. Is it going to be F1 that's got Porsche, Super Cup, F3, F2? So, you know, there's a lot of land immediately taken before you start coming up with length of straight, tightness of corner for turn one, et cetera, et cetera.
We get a lot of inquiries for new projects, for new tracks, where, you know, a client will say, oh, we want to have a Formula One track or a MotoGP track. And then we have to go through the process of really understanding, well, do you want to host MotoGP? Do you really want to host Formula One? Or actually, do you just want to have like track days? Because, as you know, it affects the track design a lot. You know, much bigger track, much bigger runoff areas, bigger buildings. So we do a lot of club tracks here as well that are not hosting these larger events, and it changes the track design pretty massively and the budget as well. So,
and the safety element, doesn't it? Yeah. You know, we said about, you know, the F1 to MotoGP, the space required for tarmac or asphalt runoff in relation to gravel, whether it's Tech Pro barriers or whether that Tech Pro comes out because you're not running F1 and you're putting air fencing in, you know, whether it's Type A, Type C, etc., you know, distance of debris fencing, intervention gaps for all your marshals, everything changes. And that's where you need to, that's where, you know, I'm working well and supporting with Driven to actually identify some of the operational issues of how does a marshal use an intervention gap to get to a point where a bike may fall, or where a car may impact that is totally different to what a bike approaches.
Yeah. Now we're rapidly running out of time. I feel like we could talk to you for ages. I just want to get through a couple of the questions that have come in from some of our listeners. Martin has asked, now this might be totally bonkers, but could you design a track that cars, for example, run one way and bikes run in the opposite direction, having the barriers when they need them?
You could, in theory. So the biggest issue we have, and it's not just whether it's cars or bikes going the other way, it's two things that stop it normally from a practical perspective, is obviously all the runoff areas are designed, you know, on the outside of a corner. So if you've got a 90 degree bend, you're gonna have runoff area in one direction, but if you want to run that two ways, all of a sudden you've got the, you know, runoff area, or double the runoff area. Some corners it's not an issue, but that, you know, on 90 degree bends, it would be,
you would have to use Armco.
But the that's the biggest thing, is that I overlap. So Armco, the guardrail, the way it's all bolted together, is overlapped in the direction of travel. So the only way you'd be able to do it is with concrete walls where you've got a completely small surface. But even then, you would need to have all the marginal overlaps reconfigured. So look, you could do it. Would it be practical? Probably not. but there's no reason why you couldn't design it in an ideal world.
Yeah.
Nobody cared when they ran the Hutchinson 100 around Brands Hatch the opposite way around.
A few videos and circuits being used in reverse direction. So, and then you've got things like all your curbs. You know, your curbs are certain direction for all your positive curbs, all your signage, your lights, your pit lane entry and exit, your garages, you know, race control. So when you start to unpick it, it becomes, we get asked that a lot. Can we run both directions? And the answer is, well, in theory, we could do it, but we probably wouldn't advise it.
Well, yeah, there's your question answered, Martin. So for Driven, obviously you've got a bunch of projects you're working on. You know, what does the future hold? What are you excited about? What can you tell us at the moment that you're working on for the future?
It's been a really exciting few years for us. I think since we did the Abu Dhabi upgrades in 2021, that project's really helped elevate our profile a bit more, and we're becoming involved generally with some bigger projects in terms of like MotoGP and Formula One, which is really exciting. So we're hoping to be involved with the circuit longer term, to continue making progress there and updates as the track evolves and as the event continues. We've got some really cool tracks opening in India next year, which I think may get used for the bike racing of some sort, whether that's local or international, still to be determined. And then we're doing a lot of club circuits in America, so like country club concepts, where people can come and like store their bikes or cars and have kind of like a long weekend there, so like the golf course type thing. That's very, very popular at the moment. So being located in England is quite handy at the moment, because it's America and India seem to be the two areas where we're working a lot. We'll have to keep you guys posted as and when we get more and more projects coming online.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been fascinating, and I know there's still a lot more we could talk about, but you've got to join us for extra as well, to have a little look at Valencia, the final round of MotoGP. But for now, Ben, Gary from Driven International, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to speak with you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.